and Danny had to worry it with her teeth and chew each mouthful a long time. No steel was permitted within the sacred confines of Vaes Dothrak, beneath the shadow of the Mother of Mountains. She had to rip the heart apart with teeth and nails. Her stomach roiled and heaved. Yet she kept on, her face smeared with the heart's blood that sometimes seemed to explode against her lips. Khal Drogo stood over her as she ate, his face as hard as a bronze shield. His long black braid was shiny with oil. He wore gold rings in his moustache, gold bells in his braid, and a heavy belt of solid gold medallions around his waist. But his chest was bare. She looked at him whenever she felt her strength failing, looked at him and chewed and swallowed, chewed and swallowed, chewed and swallowed. Towards the end, Danny thought, she glimpsed a fierce pride in his dark, almond-shaped eyes, but she could not be sure. The car's face did not often betray the thoughts within. And finally, it was done. Her cheeks and fingers were sticky as she forced down the last of it. Only then did she turn her eyes back to the old women, the crones of the Dashkalin. "Kalaka Dathre Mahrana," she proclaimed in her best Dothraki. "A prince rides inside me." She had practiced the phrase for days with her handmaid Jiqui. The oldest of the crones, a bent and shriveled stick of a woman with a single black eye, raised her arms on high. "Kalaka Dathre," she shrieked. "The prince is riding."
"He is riding," the other women answered.
"Rock, rock, rock, Hajj," they proclaimed. A boy, a strong boy."
Bells rang, a sudden clangor of bronze birds. A deep-throated war horn sounded its long, low note. The old women began to chant. Underneath their painted leather vests, their withered dug swayed back and forth, shiny with oil and sweat. The eunuchs who served them threw bundles of dried grasses into a great bronze brazier, and clouds of fragrant smoke rose up toward the moon and the stars. The Dothraki believed the stars were horses made of fire, a great herd that galloped across the sky by night. As the smoke ascended, the chanting died away, and the ancient crone closed her single eye, the better to peer into the future. The silence that fell was complete. Danny could hear the distant call of night birds, the hiss and crackle of the torches, the gentle lapping of water from the lake. The Dothraki stared at her with eyes of night, waiting. Khal Drogo laid his hand on Danny's arm. She could feel the tension in his fingers. Even a Khal as mighty as Drogo could know fear when the Dashkalin peered into smoke of the future. At her back, her handmaids fluttered anxiously. Finally the crone opened her eye and lifted her arms.
"I have seen his face and heard the thunder of his hooves," she proclaimed in a thin, wavery voice.
"The thunder of his hooves," the others chorused.
"As swift as the wind he rides, and behind him his Khalasar covers the earth, men without number, with arcs shining in their hands like blades of razor glass. Fierce as a storm this prince will be. His enemies will tremble before him. Their wives will weep tears of blood and rend their flesh in grief. The bells in his hair will sing his coming, and the milkmen in their stone tents will fear his name."
The old woman trembled and looked at Danny almost as if she were afraid.
"The prince is riding, and he shall be the stallion who mounts the world."
"The stallion who mounts the world," the onlookers cried in echo, until the night rang to the sound of their voices. The one-eyed crone peered at Danny.
"What shall he be called, this stallion who mounts the world?"
She stood to answer.
"He shall be called Rago," she said, using the words that Jiqui had taught her. Her hands touched the swell beneath her breasts protectively as a roar went up from the Dothraki. "Rago!" they screamed. "Rago! Rago! Rago!" The name was still ringing in her ears as Khal Drogo led her from the pit. His blood riders fell in behind them. A procession followed them out onto the God's Way, the broad grassy road that ran through the heart of Vaes Dothrak, from the Horse Gate to the Mother of Mountains. The crones of the Dashkalin came first, with their eunuchs and slaves. Some supported themselves with tall carved staffs as they struggled along on ancient, shaking legs, whilst others walked as proud as any horse lord. Each of the old women had been a Khaleesi once, when their lord husbands died and a new Khal took his place at the front of his riders, with a new Khaleesi mounted beside him. They were sent here to reign over the vast Dothraki nation. Even the mightiest of Khals bowed to the wisdom and authority of the Dashkalin. Still, it gave Danny the shivers to think that one day she might be sent to join them, whether she willed it or no. Behind the wise women came the others, Khal Ogo and his son, the Kalaka Fogo, Khal Jomo and his wives, the chief men of Drogo's Khalasar, Danny's handmaids, the Khal's servants and slaves, and more. Bells rang, and drums beat a stately cadence as they marched along the God's Way. Stolen heroes and the gods of dead peoples brooded in the darkness beyond the road. Alongside the procession, slaves ran lightly through the grass, with torches in their hands, and the flickering flames made the great monuments seem almost alive.
"What is meaning name Rago?"
Khal Drogo asked as they walked, using the common tongue of the Seven Kingdoms. She had been teaching him a few words when she could. Drogo was quick to learn when he put his mind to it, though his accent was so thick and barbarous that neither Sajara nor Viserys could understand a word he said. "My brother Rhaegar was a fierce warrior, my son and stars," she told him. "He died before I was born. Sajara says he was the last of the dragons." Khal Drogo looked down at her. His face was a copper mask, yet under the long black moustache, drooping beneath the weight of its gold rings, she thought she glimpsed the shadow of a smile.
"Is good name Dan Eri's wife, moon of my life," he said.
They rode to the lake the Dothraki called the Womb of the World, surrounded by a fringe of reeds, its water still and calm. A thousand years ago, Jiqui told her, the first man had emerged from its depths, riding upon the back of the first horse. The procession waited on the grassy shore as Danny stripped and let her soiled clothing fall to the ground. Naked, she stepped gingerly into the water. Iria said the lake had no bottom, but Danny felt soft mud squishing between her toes as she pushed through the tall reeds. The moon floated on the still black waters, shattering and reforming as her ripples washed over it. Goose pimples rose on her pale skin as the coldness crept up her thighs and kissed her lower lips. The stallion's blood had dried on her hands and around her mouth. Danny cupped her fingers and lifted the sacred waters over her head, cleansing herself and the child inside her, while the Khal and the others looked on. She heard the old women of the Dashkalin muttering to each other as they watched, and wondered what they were saying. When she emerged from the lake, shivering and dripping, a handmaid, Doria, hurried to her with a robe of painted sand silk, but Khal Drogo waved her away. He was looking on her swollen breasts and the curve of her belly with approval, and Danny could see the shape of his manhood pressing through his horsehide trousers below the heavy gold medallions of his belt. She went to him and helped him unlace. Then her huge Khal took her by the hips
and lifted her into the air as he might lift a child. The bells in his hair rang softly. Danny wrapped her arms around his shoulders and pressed her face against his neck as he thrust himself inside her. Three quick strokes, and it was done.
"The stallion who mounts the world," Drogo whispered hoarsely.
His hands still smelt of horse blood. He bit at her throat hard in the moment of his pleasure, and when he lifted her off, his seed filled her and trickled down the inside of her thighs. Only then was Daria permitted to drape her in the scented sand silk, and Iri to fit soft slippers to her feet. Khal Drogo laced himself up and spoke a command, and horses were brought to the lakeshore. Kahalo had the honor of helping the Khaleesi onto her silver. Drogo spurred his stallion and set off down the God's Way beneath the moon and stars. On her silver, Danny easily kept pace. The silk tenting that roofed Khal Drogo's hall had been rolled up tonight, and the moon followed them inside. Flames leapt 10 feet in the air from the three huge stone-lined fire pits. The air was thick with the smell of roasting meat and curdled fermented mare's milk. The hall was crowded and noisy when they entered, the cushions packed with those whose rank and name were not sufficient to allow them at the ceremony. As Danny rode beneath the arched entry and up the center aisle, every eye was on her. The Dothraki screamed out comments on her belly and her breasts, hailing the life within her. She could not understand all they shouted, but one phrase came clear. "The stallion that mounts the world," she heard, bellowed in 1,000 voices. The sounds of drums and horns swirled up into the night. Half-clothed women spun and danced on the low tables, amidst joints of meat and platters piled high with plums and dates and pomegranates. Many of the men were drunk on clotted mare's milk, yet Danny knew no Arraks would clash tonight. Not here, in the sacred city, where blades and bloodshed were forbidden. Khal Drogo dismounted and took his place on the high bench. Khal Jomo and Khal Ogo, who had been in Vae's Death Rock with their Khalasars when they arrived, were given seats of high honor to Drogo's right and left. The blood riders of the three Khals sat below them, and farther down, Khal Jomo's four wives. Danny climbed off her silver and gave the reins to one of the slaves. As Doria and Iri arranged her cushions, she searched for her brother. Even across the length of the crowded hall, Viserys should have been conspicuous with his pale skin, silvery hair, and beggar's rags, but she did not see him anywhere. Her glance roamed the crowded tables near the walls, where men, whose braids were even shorter than their manhoods, sat on frayed rugs and flat cushions around the low tables, but all the faces she saw had black eyes and copper skin. She spied Ser Jorah Mormont near the center of the hall, close to the middle fire pit. It was a place of respect, if not high honor. The Dothraki esteemed the knight's prowess with a sword. Danny sent Shikri to bring him to her table. Mormont came at once and went to one knee before her.
"Khaleesi," he said, "I'm yours to command."
She patted the stuffed horsehide cushion beside her. "Sit and talk with me."
"Oh, you honor me?"
The knight seated himself cross-legged on the cushion. A slave knelt before him, offering a wooden platter full of ripe figs. Ser Jorah took one and bit it in half. "Where is my brother?" Danny asked. "He ought to have come by now, for the feast."
I saw his grace this morning," he told her. "He told me he was going to the Western Market in search of wine."
"Wine?" Danny said doubtfully. Viserys could not abide the taste of the fermented mare's milk the Dothraki drank. She knew that. And he was oft at the bazaars these days, drinking with the traders who came in the great caravans from east and west. He seemed to find their company more congenial than hers.
"Wine," Ser Jorah confirmed. "And he has some thought to recruit men for his army from the sellswords who guard the caravans." A servant girl laid a blood pie in front of him, and he attacked it with both hands. "Is that why?" she asked. "He has no gold to pay soldiers. What if he's betrayed?" Caravan guards were seldom troubled much by thoughts of honour, and the usurper in King's Landing would pay well for her brother's head. "You ought to have gone with him to keep him safe. You are his sworn sword."
"We are in Vaes Dothrak," he reminded her. "No one may carry a blade here, or shed a man's blood."
"Yet men die," she said. "Jogo told me. Some of the traders have eunuchs with them, huge men, who strangle thieves with wisps of silk. That way no blood is shed, and the guards are not angered."
"Then let us hope your brother will be wise enough not to steal anything."
Sir Jorah wiped the grease off his mouth with the back of his hand and leaned close over the table.
"He had planned to take your dragon's eggs, until I warned him that I'd cut off his hand if he so much as touched them."
For a moment Danny was so shocked she had no words.
"My eggs? But they're mine. Magister Illyrio gave them to me, a bridal gift. Why would Viserys want... They're only stones."
"The same could be said of rubies and diamonds and fire opals, Princess. And the dragon's eggs are rarer by far. Those traders he's been drinking with would sell their own manhoods for even one of those stones. And with all three, Viserys could buy as many cell swords as he might need."
Danny had not known, had not even suspected. Then he should have them. He does not need to steal them. He had only to ask. He is my brother, and my true king.
He is your brother, Sir Jorah acknowledged.
You do not understand, sir, she said. My mother died, giving me birth, and my father and my brother Rhaegar even before that. I would never have known so much as their names if Viserys had not been there to tell me. He was the only one left. The only one. He is all I have.
Once, said Sir Jorah. No longer, Khaleesi. You belong to the Dothraki now. In your womb rides a stallion who mounts the world.
He held out his cup, and a slave filled it with fermented mare's milk, sour-smelling and thick with clots. Danny waved her away. Even the smell of it made her feel ill, and she would take no chances of bringing up the horse's heart. She had forced herself to eat. What does it mean, she asked. What is this stallion? Everyone was shouting it at me, but I don't understand.
A stallion is the Carl of Carls, promised in ancient prophecy, child. He will unite the Dothraki into a single Khalasar and ride to the ends of the earth. Or so it was promised. All the people of the world will be his herd.
Oh, Danny said in a small voice. Her hand smoothed her robe down over the swell of her stomach. I named him Rhaego.
A name to make the usurper's blood run cold.
Suddenly Doria was tugging at her elbow. My lady, the handmaid whispered urgently, your brother. Danny looked down the length of the long, roofless hall, and there he was, striding toward her. From the lurch in his step, she could tell at once that Viserys had found his wine, and something that passed for courage. He was wearing his scarlet silks, soiled and travel-stained. His cloak and gloves were black velvet, faded from the sun. His boots were dry and cracked, his silver-blonde hair matted and tangled. A longsword swung from his belt in a leather scabbard. The Dothraki eyed the sword as he passed. Danny heard curses and threats and angry muttering rising all around her like a tide. The music died away in a nervous stammering of drums. A sense of dread closed round her heart.
Go to him, she commanded Sir Jorah. Stop him. Bring him here. Tell him he can have the dragon's eggs, if that's what he wants.
The knight rose swiftly to his feet.
Where is my sister?
Viserys shouted, his voice thick with wine.
I've come for her feast. How dare you presume to eat without me? No one eats before the king. Where is she? The whore can't hide from the dragon.
He stopped beside the largest of the three fire pits, peering around at the faces of the Dothraki.
There were 5,000 men in the hall, but only a handful who knew the common tongue. Yet even if his words were incomprehensible, you had only to look at him to know that he was drunk. So Jorah went to him swiftly, whispered something in his ear, and took him by the arm, but Viserys wrenched free. "Keep your hands off me! No one touches the dragon without leave!" Danny glanced anxiously up at the high bench. Khal Drogo was saying something to the other Khals beside him. Khal Jomo grinned, and Khal Ogo began to guffaw loudly. The sound of laughter made Viserys lift his eyes. "Khal Drogo," he said thickly, his voice almost polite. "I'm here for the feast." He staggered away from Ser Jorah, making to join the three Khals on the high bench. Khal Drogo rose, spat out a dozen words in Dothraki, faster than Danny could understand, and pointed. "Khal Drogo says, your place is not on the high bench," Ser Jorah translated for her brother. "Khal Drogo says, your place is there." Viserys glanced where the Khal was pointing. At the back of the long hall, in a corner by the wall, deep in shadow, so better men would not need to look on them, sat the lowest of the low. Raw, unblooded boys, old men with clouded eyes and stiff joints, the dim-witted and the maimed. Far from the meat, and farther from honor.
"That is no place for a king," her brother declared.
"Is place,"
Khal Drogo answered in the common tongue that Danny had taught him.
"For sore foot king."
He clapped his hands together.
"A cart! Bring cart for Khal Ragat!"
5,000 Dothraki began to laugh and shout. Ser Jorah was standing beside Viserys, screaming in his ear, but the roar in the hall was so thunderous that Danny could not hear what he was saying. Her brother shouted back, and the two men grappled, until Mormont knocked Viserys bodily to the floor. Her brother drew his sword. The bared steel shone a fearful red in the glare from the fire pits.
"Keep away from me!"
Viserys hissed. Ser Jorah backed off a step, and her brother climbed unsteadily to his feet. He waved the sword over his head, the borrowed blade that Magister Illyrio had given him to make him seem more kingly. Dothraki were shrieking at him from all sides, screaming vile curses. Danny gave a wordless cry of terror. She knew what a drawn sword meant here, even if her brother did not. Her voice made Viserys turn his head, and he saw her for the first time.
"There she is,"
he said, smiling. He stalked toward her, slashing at the air as if to cut a path through a wall of enemies, though no one tried to bar his way.
"The blade." "You must not," she begged him. "Please, Viserys, it is forbidden. Put down the sword and come share my cushions. There's drink, food. Is it the dragon's eggs you want? You can have them. Only throw away the sword."
"Do as she tells you, fool," Ser Jorah shouted, "before you get us all killed."
Viserys laughed.
"They can't kill us. They can't shed blood here in the sacred city, but I can."
He laid the point of his sword between Daenerys' breasts and slid it downwards over the curve of her belly.
"I want what I came for," he told her. "I want the crown he promised me. He bought you, but he never paid for you. Tell him I want what I bargained for, or I'm taking you back, you and the eggs both. He can keep his bloody foal. I'll cut the bastard out and leave it for him."
The sword point pushed through her silks and pricked at her navel. Viserys was weeping, she saw, weeping and laughing both at the same time, this man who had once been her brother. Distantly, as from far away, Danny heard her handmaid Jiqui sobbing in fear, pleading that she dared not translate, that the Khal would bind her and drag her behind his horses all the way up the Mother of Mountains. She put her arm around the girl. "Don't be afraid," she said. "I shall tell him." She did not know if she had enough words. Yet when she was done, Khal Drogo spoke a few brusque sentences in Dothraki, and she knew he understood. The son of her life stepped down from the high bench.
"What did he say?"
the man who had been her brother asked, flinching. It had grown so silent in the hall that she could hear the bells in Khal Drogo's hair chiming softly with each step he took. His blood riders followed him, like three copper shadows. Daenerys had gone cold all over. "He says, 'You shall have a splendid golden crown that men shall tremble to behold.'" Viserys smiled and lowered his sword. That was the saddest thing, the thing that tore at her afterward, the way he smiled.
"That was all I wanted," he said. "What was promised?"
When the son of her life reached her, Danny slid an arm around his waist. The Carl said a word, and his blood riders leapt forward. Kothos seized the man, who had been her brother, by the arms. Hago shattered his wrist with a single sharp twist of his huge hands. Kahalo pulled the sword from his limp fingers. Even now, Viserys did not understand.
"No!" he shouted. "You cannot touch me! I am the dragon! The dragon! And I will be crowned!"
Khal Drogo unfastened his belt. The medallions were pure gold, massive and ornate, each one as large as a man's hand. He shouted a command. Cook slaves pulled a heavy iron stew pot from the fire pit, dumped the stew onto the ground, and returned the pot to the flames. Drogo tossed in the belt and watched without expression as the medallions turned red and began to lose their shape. She could see fires dancing in the onyx of his eyes. A slave handed him a pair of thick horsehair mittens, and he pulled them on, never so much as looking at the man. Viserys began to scream, the high, wordless scream of the coward facing death. He kicked and twisted, whimpered like a dog, and wept like a child, but the Dothraki held him tight between them. Sir Jorah had made his way to Danny's side. He put a hand on her shoulder.
"Turn away, my princess, I beg you."
"No." She folded her arms across the swell of her belly protectively. At the last, Viserys looked at her.
"Sister, please, Danny, tell them, make them, sweet sister."
When the gold was half melted and starting to run, Drogo reached into the flames, snatched out the pot.
"Crown!" he roared. "Here, a crown for Khart King!"
And upended the pot over the head of the man who had been her brother. The sound Viserys Targaryen made when that hideous iron helmet covered his face was like nothing human. His feet hammered a frantic beat against the dirt floor, slowed, stopped. Thick globs of molten gold dripped down onto his chest, setting the scarlet silk to smouldering. Yet no drop of blood was spilled. He was no dragon, Danny thought, curiously calm. Fire cannot kill a dragon. Eddard. He was walking through the crypts beneath Winterfell, as he had walked a thousand times before. The kings of Winter watched him pass with eyes of ice, and the dire wolves at their feet turned their great stone heads and snarled. Last of all he came to the tomb, where his father slept, with Brandon and Lyanna beside him. "Promise me, Ned," Lyanna's statue whispered. She wore a garland of pale blue roses, and her eyes wept blood. Eddard Stark jerked upright, his heart racing, the blankets tangled around him. The room was black as pitch, and someone was hammering on the door.
"Lord Eddard,
a voice called loudly. A moment! Groggy and naked, he stumbled his way across the darkened chamber. When he opened the door, he found Tomard, with an upraised fist, and Cain, with a taper in hand. Between them stood the king's own steward. The man's face might have been carved of stone, so little did it show. "My Lord Hand," he intoned, "His Grace, the King, commands your presence at once." Sir Robert had returned from his hunt. It was long past time. "I shall need a few moments to dress." Ned left the man waiting without. Cairn helped him with his clothes. White linen tunic and grey cloak, trousers slit open down his plaster-sheathed leg, his badge of office, and last of all, a belt of heavy silver links. He sheathed the Valyrian dagger at his waist. The Red Keep was dark and still, as Cain and Tomard escorted him across the inner bailey. The moon hung low over the walls, ripening toward full. On the ramparts, a guardsman in a gold cloak walked his rounds. The royal apartments were in Magor's Holdfast, a massive square fortress that nestled in the heart of the Red Keep, behind walls 12 foot thick and a dry moat lined with iron spikes, a castle within a castle. Sir Boris Blunt guarded the far end of the bridge, white-steeled armour ghostly in the moonlight. Within, Ned passed two other knights of the King's Guard. Sir Preston Greenfield stood at the bottom of the steps, and Sir Barristan Selmy waited at the door of the King's bedchamber. Three men, in white cloaks, he thought, remembering, and a strange chill went through him. Sir Barristan's face was as pale as his armour. Ned had only to look at him to know that something was dreadfully wrong. The royal steward opened the door. "Lord Eddard Stark, the Hand of the King," he announced.
"Bring him here,"
Robert's voice called, strangely thick. Fires blazed in the twin hearths at either end of the bedchamber, filling the room with a sullen red glare. The heat within was suffocating. Robert lay across the canopied bed. At the bedside hovered Grand Maester Pycelle, while Lord Renly paced restlessly before the shuttered windows. Servants moved back and forth, feeding logs to the fire and boiling wine. Cersei Lannister sat on the edge of the bed beside her husband. Her hair was tousled, as if from sleep, but there was nothing sleepy in her eyes. They followed Ned as Tomard and Cain helped him cross the room. He seemed to move very slowly, as if he were still dreaming. The king still wore his boots. Ned could see dried mud and blades of grass clinging to the leather where Robert's feet stuck out beneath the blanket that covered him. A green doublet lay on the floor, slashed open and discarded, the cloth crusted with red-brown stains. The room smelled of smoke and blood and death.
"Ned,"
the king whispered when he saw him. His face was pale as milk.
"Come closer."
His men brought him close. Ned steadied himself with a hand on the bedpost. He had only to look down at Robert to know how bad it was.
"What?"
he began, his throat clenched.
"A boar."
Lord Renly was still in his hunting greens, his cloak spattered with blood.
"A devil," the king husked. "My own fault. Too much wine. Damn me to hell. Missed my thrust."
"And where were the rest of you?" Ned demanded of Lord Renly. "Where were Sir Barristan and the King's Guard?" Renly's mouth twitched. "My brother commanded us to stand aside and let him take the boar alone." Eddard Stark lifted the blanket. They had done what they could to close him up, but it was nowhere near enough. The boar must have been a fearsome thing. It had ripped the king from groin to nipple with its tusks. The wine-soaked bandages that Grand Maester Pycelle had applied were already black with blood, and the smell off the wound was hideous. Ned's stomach turned. He let the blanket fall.
"Stinks," Robert said. "The stink of death. Don't think I can't smell it. Bastard did me good, eh? But I paid him back in kind, Ned."
The king's smile was as terrible as his wound. His teeth red.
"Drew a knife right through his eye. Ask them if I didn't. Ask them."
"Truly," Lord Renly murmured, "we brought the carcass back with us, at my brother's command."
"For the feast," Robert whispered. "Now leave us, the lot of you. I need to speak with Ned."
"Robert, my sweet lord," Cersei began.
"I said leave,"
Robert insisted, with a hint of his old fierceness.
"What part of that don't you understand, woman?"
Cersei gathered up her skirts and her dignity and led the way to the door. Lord Renly and the others followed. Grand Maester Pycelle lingered, his hands shaking as he offered the king a cup of thick white liquid.
"The milk of the puppy, Your Grace," he said. "Drink for your pain."
Robert knocked the cup away with the back of his hand.
"Away with you! I'll sleep soon enough. All full, get out."
Grand Maester Pycelle gave Ned a stricken look as he shuffled from the room.
"Damn you, Robert,"
Ned said when they were alone. His leg was throbbing so badly he was almost blind with pain. Or perhaps it was grief that fogged his eyes. He lowered himself to the bed beside his friend.
"Why do you always have to be so headstrong?"
"Oh, fuck you, Ned," the king said hoarsely. "I killed the bastard, didn't I?"
A lock of matted black hair fell across his eyes as he glared up at Ned.
"Ought to do the same for you. Can't leave a man to hunt in peace. Sir Robar found me. Gregor's head. Ugly thought. Never told the hound. Let Cersei surprise him."
His laugh turned into a grunt as a spasm of pain hit him.
"God have mercy," he muttered, swallowing his agony. "That girl Daenerys, only a child. You were right. That's why the girl... The god sent the boar. Sent to punish me."
The king coughed, bringing up blood.
"Wrong. I was wrong. I am only a girl. Varys, Littlefinger, even my brother, worthless. No one to tell me no but you, Ned. Only you."
He lifted his hand, the gesture pained and feeble.
"Paper and ink, there, on the table. Write what I tell you."
Ned smoothed the paper out across his knee and took up the quill. "At your command, Your Grace."
"This is the will and word of Robert of House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals and all the rest. Put in the damn titles, you know how it goes. I do hereby command Eddard of House Stark, Lord of Winterfell, and Hand of the Keen, to serve as Lord Regent and Protector of the Realm upon my death, to rule in my stead, until my son Joffrey does come of age."
"Robert, Joffrey is not your son," he wanted to say, but the words would not come. The agony was written too plainly across Robert's face. He could not hurt him more. So Ned bent his head and wrote. But where the king had said, "My son Joffrey," he scrawled, "My heir," instead. The deceit made him feel soiled. "The lies we tell for love," he thought. "May the gods forgive me." "What else would you have me say?"
"Say? Whatever you need to protect and defend, gods old and new. You have the words, right? I'll sign it. You give it to the council when I'm dead."
"Robert," Ned said, in a voice thick with grief,
"you must not do this. Don't die on me. The realm needs you."
Robert took his hand, fingers squeezing hard.
"You are such a bad liar, Ned Stark," he said through his pain. "The realm? The realm knows what a wretched king I've been. Bad as Ares, the gods spare me.
No, Ned told his dying friend. Not so bad as Ares, your grace. Not near so bad as Ares. Robert managed a weak red smile.
At the least, they will say, this last thing, this I did right. You won't fear me. You'll rule now. You'll hate it worse than I did, but you'll do well. Are you done with the scribbling?
Yes, your grace. Ned offered Robert the paper. The king scrawled his signature blindly, leaving a smear of blood across the letter. The seal should be witnessed.
Serve the boar at my funeral feast, Robert rasped. Apple in his mouth. Skin, seared crisp. Eat the bastard. Don't care if you choke on him. Promise me, Ned.
I promise. Promise me, Ned. Lyanna's voice echoed.
The girl, the king said. Daenerys, let her live. If you can, if it not too late. Talk to them. Varys, little finger. Don't let them kill her. And help my son, Ned. Make him be better than me.
He winced.
Gods, have mercy.
They will, my friend, Ned said. They will. The king closed his eyes and seemed to relax.
Killed by a pig, he muttered. Ought to laugh, but it hurts too much.
Ned was not laughing. Shall I call them back? Robert gave a weak nod.
As you will. God, why is it so cold in here?
The servants rushed back in and hurried to feed the fires. The queen had gone. That was some small relief, at least. If she had any sense, Cersei would take her children and fly before the break of day, Ned thought. She had lingered too long already. King Robert did not seem to miss her. He bid his brother Renly and Grand Maester Pycelle to stand in witness as he pressed his seal into the hot yellow wax that Ned had dripped upon his letter.
Now give me something for the pain, and let me die.
Hurriedly, Grand Maester Pycelle mixed him another draught of the milk of the puppy. This time the king drank deeply. His black beard was beaded with thick white droplets when he threw the empty cup aside.
Will I dream?
Ned gave him his answer.
You will, my lord. Good, he said, smiling. I will give Lyanna your love, Ned. Take care. Have my children for me.
The words twisted in Ned's belly like a knife. For a moment, he was at a loss. He could not bring himself to lie. Then he remembered the bastards. Little Barra at her mother's breast, Maya in the Vale, Gendry at his forge, and all the others. I shall guard your children as if they were my own, he said slowly. Robert nodded and closed his eyes. Ned watched his old friend sag softly into the pillows as the milk of the poppy washed the pain from his face. Sleep took him. Heavy chains jangled softly as Grand Maester Pycelle came up to Ned.
I will do all in my power, my lord, but the wound has mortified. It took them 2 days to get him back. By the time I saw him, it was too late. I can lessen his grace's suffering, but only the gods can heal him now.
How long? Ned asked.
By rights he should be dead already. I have never seen a man cling to life so fiercely.
My brother was always strong, Lord Renly said. Not wise, perhaps, but strong. In the sweltering heat of the bedchamber, his brow was slick with sweat. He might have been Robert's ghost as he stood there, young and dark and handsome. He slew the boar. His entrails were sliding from his belly, yet somehow
He slew the boar. His voice was full of wonder.
Robert was never a man to leave the battleground, so long as a foe remained standing, Ned told him. Outside the door, Sir Barristan Selmyr still guarded the tower steps. "Maester Pycelle has given Robert the milk of the poppy," Ned told him. "See that no one disturbs his rest without leave from me."
"It shall be as you command, my lord."
Sir Barristan seemed old beyond his years.
"I have failed my sacred trust."
"Even the truest knight cannot protect a king against himself," Ned said. "Robert loved to hunt boar. I have seen him take 1,000 of them. He would stand his ground without flinching, his legs braced, his great spear in his hands, and as often as not he would curse the boar as it charged, and wait until the last possible second, until it was almost on him, before he killed it with a single sure and savage thrust. No one could know this one would be his death."
"You are kind to say so, Lord Eddard."
"The king himself said as much. He blamed the wine." The white-haired knight gave a weary nod.
"His grace was reeling in his saddle by the time we flushed the boar from his lair, yet he commanded us all to stand aside."
"I wonder, Sir Barristan," said Varys so quietly, "who gave the king this wine?"
Ned had not heard the eunuch approach, but when he looked around, there he stood. He wore a black velvet robe that brushed the floor, and his face was freshly powdered.
"The wine was from the king's own skin," Sir Barristan said. "Only one skin? Hunting is such thirsty work."
"I did not keep count, more than one for a certainty. Esquire would fetch him a fresh skin whenever he required it."
"Such a dutiful boy," said Varys, "to make certain his grace did not lack for refreshment."
Ned had a bitter taste in his mouth. He recalled the two fair-haired boys Robert had sent chasing after a breastplate stretcher. The king had told everyone the tale that night of the feast, laughing until he shook. "Which squire?"
"The elder," said Sir Barristan, "Lancel."
"I know the lad well," said Varys. "A stalwart boy, Sir Kevin Lannister's son, nephew to Lord Tywin, and cousin to the Queen. I hope the dear sweet lad does not blame himself. Children are so vulnerable in the innocence of their youth. How well do I remember?"
Certainly Varys had once been young. Ned doubted that he'd ever been innocent.
"You mention children. Robert had a change of heart concerning Daenerys Targaryen. Whatever arrangements you made, I want unmade, at once."
"Alas," said Varys, "at once may be too late. I fear those birds have flown. But I shall do what I can, my lord, with your leave."
He bowed and vanished down the steps, his soft-soled slippers whispering against the stone as he made his descent. Cain and Tamar were helping Ned across the bridge when Lord Renly emerged from Magor's Holdfast.
"Lord Eddard," he called after Ned, "a moment, if you'll be so kind."
Ned stopped.
"As you wish." Renly walked to his side. "Send your men away."
They met in the center of the bridge, the dry moat beneath them. Moonlight silvered the cruel edges of the spikes that lined its bed. Ned gestured. Tamard and Cain bowed their heads and backed away respectfully. Lord Renly glanced warily at Sir Boris at the far end of the span, at Sir Preston in the doorway behind them.
"That letter," he leaned close, "was it the Regency? Has my brother named you protector?"
He did not wait for reply.
"My lord, I have 30 men in my personal guard, and other friends besides, knights and lords. Give me an hour, and I can put 100 swords in your hand."
"And what should I do with 100 swords, my lord?"
"Strike! Now, while the castle sleeps."
Renly looked back at Sir Boris again and dropped his voice to an urgent whisper.
"We must get Joffrey away from his mother and take him in hand.
protector or no. The man who holds the king holds the kingdom. We should seize Marcella and Tommen as well. Once we have our children, Cersei will not dare oppose us. The council will confirm you as Lord Protector and make Joffrey your ward.
Ned regarded him coldly. Robert is not dead yet. The guards may spare him. If not, I shall convene the council to hear his final words and consider the matter of the succession. But I will not dishonor his last hours on earth by shedding blood in his halls and dragging frightened children from their beds. Lord Renly took a step back, taut as a bowstring.
Every moment you delay gives Cersei another moment to prepare. By the time Robert dies, it may be too late for both of us.
Then we should pray that Robert does not die.
Small chance of that, said Renly.
Sometimes the guards are merciful.
The Lannisters are not.
Lord Renly turned away and went back across the moat to the tower where his brother lay dying. By the time Ned returned to his chambers, he felt weary and heartsick. Yet there was no question of his going back to sleep, not now. When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die, Cersei Lannister had told him in the Godswood. He found himself wondering if he had done the right thing by refusing Lord Renly's offer. He had no taste for these intrigues, and there was no honour in threatening children. And yet, if Cersei elected to fight rather than flee, he might well have need of Renly's 100 swords, and more besides. "I want Littlefinger," he told Cain. "If he's not in his chambers, take as many men as you need and search every wine sink and whorehouse in King's Landing until you find him. Bring him to me before break of day." Cain bowed and took his leave, and Ned turned to Tomard. "The Wind Witch sails on the evening tide. Have you chosen the escort?"
10 men with Porter in command.
20, and you will command, Ned said. Porter was a brave man, but headstrong. He wanted someone more solid and sensible to keep watch over his daughters.
As you wish, my lord, Tom said. Can't say I'll be sad to see the back of this place. I miss the wife.
You will pass near Dragonstone when you turn north. I need you to deliver a letter for me. Tom looked apprehensive.
To Dragonstone, my lord.
The island fortress of House Targaryen had a sinister repute. Tell Captain Koss to hoist my banner as soon as he comes in sight of the island. They may be wary of unexpected visitors. If he is reluctant, offer him whatever it takes. I will give you a letter to place into the hand of Lord Stannis Baratheon. No one else. Not his steward. Not the captain of his guard, nor his lady wife, but only Lord Stannis himself.
As you command, my lord.
When Tomard had left him, Lord Eddard Stark sat staring at the flame of the candle that burned beside him on the table. For a moment, his grief overwhelmed him. He wanted nothing so much as to seek out the Godswood, to kneel before the heart tree and pray for the life of Robert Baratheon, who had been more than a brother to him. Men would whisper afterwards that Eddard Stark had betrayed his king's friendship and disinherited his sons. He could only hope that the guards would know better, and that Robert would learn the truth of it in the land beyond the grave. Ned took out the king's last letter, a roll of crisp white parchment sealed with golden wax, a few short words, and a smear of blood. How small the difference between victory and defeat, between life and death. He drew out a fresh sheet of paper and dipped his quill in the inkpot. To His Grace Stannis of the House Baratheon, he wrote, by the time you receive this letter, your brother Robert, our king, these past 15 years, will be dead. He was savaged by a boar whilst hunting in the king's wood. The letters seemed to writhe and twist on the paper as his hand trailed to a stop. Lord Tywin and Sir Jaime were not men to suffer disgrace meekly. they would fight rather than flee. No doubt Lord Stannis was wary after the murder of John Arryn, but it was imperative that he sail for King's Landing at once with all his power before the Lannisters could march. Ned chose each word with care. When he was done, he signed the letter, Eddard Stark, Lord of Winterfell, Hand of the King, and Protector of the Realm, blotted the paper, folded it twice, and melted the sealing wax over the candle flame. His regency would be a short one, he reflected, as the wax softened. The new king would choose his own hand. Ned would be free to go home. The thought of Winterfell brought a wan smile to his face. He wanted to hear Bran's laughter once more, to go hawking with Rob, to watch Rickon at play. He wanted to drift off to a dreamless sleep in his own bed, with his arms wrapped tight around his lady, Catelyn. Cain returned, as he was pressing the direwolf seal down into the soft white wax. Desmond was with him, and between them, Littlefinger. Ned thanked his guards and sent them away. Lord Petyr was clad in a blue velvet tunic with puff sleeves, his silvery cape patterned with mockingbirds. "I suppose congratulations are in order," he said as he seated himself. Ned scowled. "The king lies wounded and near to death." "I know," Littlefinger said. "I also know that Robert has named you Protector of the Realm." Ned's eyes flicked to the king's letter on the table before him, its seal unbroken. "And how is it you know that, my lord?" "Varys hinted as much," Littlefinger said. "And you have just confirmed it." Ned's mouth twisted in anger. "Damn Varys and his little birds! Catelyn spoke truly. The man has some black art. I do not trust him." "Excellent, your learning," Littlefinger leaned forward. "Yet I'll wager you did not drag me here in the black of night to discuss the eunuch." "No," Ned admitted. "I know the secret John Arryn was murdered to protect. Robert will leave no true-born son behind him. Joffrey and Tommen are Jaime Lannister's bastards, born of his incestuous union with the Queen." Littlefinger lifted an eyebrow. "Shocking," he said, in a tone that suggested he was not shocked at all. "The girl as well. No doubt. So when the king dies, the throne by rights passes to Lord Stannis, the elder of Robert's two brothers." Lord Petyr stroked his pointed beard as he considered the matter. "So it would seem, unless—" "Unless, my lord? There's no seeming to this. Stannis is the heir. Nothing can change that." "Stannis cannot take the throne without your help. If you're wise, you make certain Joffrey succeeds." Ned gave him a stony stare. "Have you no shred of honour?" "Oh, a shred, surely," Littlefinger replied negligently. "Hear me out. Stannis is no friend of yours, nor of mine. Even his brothers can scarcely stomach him. The man is iron, hard and unyielding. He'll give us a new hand and a new counsel for a certainty. No doubt he'll thank you for handing him the crown, but he won't love you for it, and his ascent will mean war. Stannis cannot rest easy on the throne until Cersei and her bastards are dead. Do you think Lord Tywin will sit idly while his daughter's head is measured for a spike? Castle Rock will rise, and not alone. Robert found it in him to pardon men who serve King Ares, so long as they did him fealty. Stannis is less forgiving. He will not have forgotten the siege of Storm's End, and the lords Tyrell and Redwine dare not. Every man who fought beneath the dragon banner, or rose with Balon Greyjoy, will have good cause to fear. Seat Stannis on the Iron Throne, and I promise you, the realm will bleed. Now look on the other side of the coin. Joffrey is but 12, and Robert gave you the regency, my lord. You are the Hand of the King, and Protector of the Realm.
The power is yours, Lord Stark. All you need do is reach out and take it. Make your peace with the Lannisters, release the imp, wed Joffrey to your Sansa,